extra microphone. We only have three of them up here.
Well, I'm tempted to say greetings again, little flock.
Where is everybody? On vacation? Hello, all of you people out there in the tape program. Sure glad you're listening. Otherwise, this would look like a sparse crowd here today.
I had an unusual experience. I won't go into a lot of detail, but I was gone last week up to the Olympic Peninsula for the funeral of my uncle, Mr. Dwight Armstrong, who died at age 80 after quite a long bout with cancer. And it was a very blustery, rainy day. I had to drive about 3.5 hours to get all the way around to a little tiny town called Quilcene, which is on the other side of the Puget Sound from Seattle, on the other side of Bremerton, as a matter of fact. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but it was quite interesting to see who all came for the funeral and, of course, who did not come. My father was over in Thailand, and he was not there. I really sort of halfway expected, frankly, to accidentally run into him. I wasn't certain one way or the other. But when I got word that my uncle had died, and then I think he died on either a Friday or a Saturday, and they were not going to have the funeral until the following Friday, and I thought, well, why would they delay that long? Usually they would have had it by Monday or Tuesday of that week. And I thought, well, it may be that my dad needs the extra time to travel back around from the other side of the world to get there for the funeral. But he didn't come there. So while I was there at the funeral, it was kind of interesting to see a few old friends and a few other familiar faces that I hadn't seen in a long time. A lot of people came up and shook hands, and some of those people included Charles Dorothy and John Hill and Devara Partian and Joe Tkach and Rod Meredith and Herman Hay and... See who all else was there. Richard Parker is a local pastor, Danny Luker, just a whole group of people that I hadn't remotely expected to see while I was there. And I don't know if they were shocked or surprised to see me there or not, but it was kind of a sad occasion, a bittersweet occasion in one way. It was very good to see some of my old friends, including Charles Dorothy and John Hill and some men like that, but it was kind of sad to see them under those circumstances. I also saw my first cousin, who I had not seen since she was 5 years of age, little Deborah Armstrong. Uncle Dwight, fantastic man, very frustrated man who did not have a happy life, the first half of his life or better, because when he was about 14 or 15, he was a violinist with the Portland Symphony. And when my grandfather Armstrong died, he had to go as a fairly young man back to the farm and take care of his aging elderly mother. And for about 30 years of his life, he was there with his widowed mother until finally, when they moved down to Southern California and they lost the farm, Karen Armstrong, then I've forgotten what her name was then, but she is John Hill's older sister, as many of you might know, began taking care of my grandmother and probably added a few years to her life, if the truth were known, because of what she did for her. And eventually, she and Dwight were married. Well, that's nearly 30 years ago now. I know that Wid and Marbeth must remember that because they've been in the church an awful long time. Some of the rest of you may well remember that. I remember my brother was still alive, and he was killed in 1958. And he was writing me one of the funniest letters I've ever read when he was over in England, and he got word that my Uncle Dwight was about to get married. He and George Meeker and one or two others were the only bachelors in the college at that time, and he said he was going to hide out and stay in England from then on because if Dwight was going to, you know, get married and fall to the axe, well, there was no telling what would happen to him. But that was interesting that about age 60, Dwight Armstrong has a little daughter, and she looks a lot like my maternal, or rather fraternal, I guess it would be, grandmother. She had a lot of characteristics in her face that looked just like Grandma Armstrong. Well, I hadn't seen her since she was about 5 years of age, so you can imagine my surprise to be able to sit there and talk to a very attractive, charming young lady of 19. And I get to be introduced to her, and then it was another couple of second cousins, and it was a first cousin I hadn't seen since he was a baby boy, who was now about my age on my mother's side. Dwight's twin sister, my Aunt Mary Edmondson, and Uncle Don Edmondson, who worked with Dim Jim, the company Daniel Mann Johnson and Mendenhall, who became the architects and engineers that developed Ambassador College. And he was a Portland, Oregon architect who was a very renowned architect and was actually recruited by Dim Jim to become their man up in Oregon, the Pacific Northwest. He is now retired from that corporation, and I imagine he is about 80 or 81. My Aunt Mary was very, very stooped and very, very elderly, looked remarkably like my grandmother Armstrong. So the family has all been rather long-lived in spite of the fact that he had a long bout with cancer. He was 80 years of age when he did die. So I thought I'd just at least pass that along to you as a matter of personal interest that did take place. I have a fellow who lives out where I do who is in the counseling business. He is, I guess you'd say, a psychiatrist. Maybe he has a degree in psychology. Matter of fact, there are two of them out there. And they're active. I won't reveal their names, but they practice here in Tyler. And their lifelong job is to take people who have problems that come into them and sit on the proverbial leather couch and lie back and tell them about all their fixations and frustrations and psychoses and neuroses, hang-ups, doubts, disillusionments, angers, resentments, and fears. I played golf with this fellow quite often until finally I quit. I just couldn't stand it anymore, and a lot of other people have felt the same way, and he became somewhat of a comic character out where I live, because when he hits a bad shot, he just loses all control. And he takes his club, and you can hear it going, you know, through the air, and it's sailing about 30 yards over there. The ball goes nowhere near as far as the club. I've been on, like, number six with him several times. He's fairly stocky, fairly heavy-built guy, and he, real slow backswing. He brings that driver up, and he's got to kill his ball, you know. Hits it on the top. It kind of drubs down here, hits a concrete block or something, and goes over into the gutter or something about 30 feet in front of the tee, and goes the driver off into the distant greenery. And he's jumping up and down and loses total control. And yet he is in the business of counseling people about losing their temper. That's unbelievable. I remember a report from a National Association of Psychiatry in which one person who addressed the group admitted and acknowledged to all of them that probably a higher percentage of people in the business of psychology and psychiatry needed treatment than perhaps any other profession. Now, it doesn't say much for my, quote, profession, although I don't really consider myself in the profession of the clergy the way the world looks at it. I want to make that very, very clear. I'm not a preacher the way the world would categorize those people. But did you know that suicide is inordinately high among the ministry? That as a class, as a profession, there is a very disproportionate number of people in both psychiatry and psychology, but especially in the ministry, who are susceptible to suicide. I well remember in the other church, the parent organization, there was a man who kind of gave a little pitiful whimper to a young man who was also a district superintendent, said he needed some help. Could he please come to visit him? Well, he was busy with his fruit trees or whatever. I'll get around to it. He decided to wait 6 or 8 weeks. He never got up to see the person, never really found out what the problem was, but the man was a minister over a large church in the WCG in the Pacific Northwest. He had asked his district or regional or whatever director, superintendent, please come up and see me. I got some problems. Well, I'll get up there, but I'm busy, you know. He didn't get up there. Well, you remember the story because it made sensational headlines. His wife was divorcing him, and one day they met in the corridor just outside her lawyer's office, and he whipped out a .357 Magnum and blew her brains out and then blew his brains out. And here was a sensational, bloody, wretched mess of a murder, suicide of a minister who was doing exactly what I'm doing today, standing in a pulpit before a congregation of God's people less than a week before, preaching out of the Bible, the Word of God, about their lives and their problems and so on, but he couldn't handle his own problems. Now, you've heard the expression time and again, garbage in, garbage out. That's sort of the new expression that came along with the computer age. To teach a lot of people, the computers really do not abscond with the funds or run away with the secretary, that computers are not separate, disembodied beings of some sort, that they only give back or put out what is put into them. And if you program them in such a way that they're only going to give you a lot of discordant, jangled, nonsensical phrases and jumbled numbers, and that's exactly what they're going to put out. But if you put into them sensible figures and various programs and so on, then they're able to give out whatever it is you put in. But whatever you get out of a computer had to be put into that computer first. The other morning on Good Morning America, it was revealed in one of these interviews they go through that every fourth American, and that astounded me because I didn't know it was that bad, that 25% of the population of the wealthiest country on the face of the earth the great Christian nation, the United States of America, are mentally unbalanced to a degree that they allegedly, according to national psychiatric and psychological organizations, need treatment, that they are not truly functional all by themselves. But what they were lamenting was that only a tiny percentage of these people ever seek treatment, become aware of the fact that they need it. Now, you can say that a lot of these things are overlapping because, you know, about 92 million Americans have a registered form of chronic disease of some sort or another. And the multiple sclerosis and the muscular dystrophy and the emphysema and the lung disease and heart disease and cancer and, of course, things like hemorrhoids are so common it's pitiful, and arthritis is so common it's pitiful, and various degrees of hearing loss and blindness and so on, and all of the various disease, glaucoma, et cetera, that affects literally millions and millions of human beings. So your typical American, this every fourth person, may also be a homosexual with a heart problem, if you see what I'm saying. They tell me that every sixth man in the United States is homosexual. They tell me that every fourth person, man and woman, is mentally aberrant in his upper story. I know that about half the population has some sort of a registered chronic disease. So I'm saying that there are a lot of queer homosexuals, you know, queers, with heart problems who also suffer from a tumor and maybe a bad case of hemorrhoids. This is the way the world is in which we live. To illustrate the point about this problem of people who are unable to really think straight, whose minds are polluted, I want to go to a couple of scriptures right quickly. Let's go to Isaiah, the first chapter, to give you a little analogy from God's point of view about our civilization and our society. And then I want to tell you a strange story of something that happened to my son a couple of days ago, right here in Tyler. Yes, right here, here in Tyler. It really happened. I'll tell you in just a moment. Isaiah 1, he's giving the analogy of a nation who has totally left its God, a sinful nation, verse 4, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the eternal, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger, they're gone away backward. Why should you be stricken anymore, like a rebellious child where simply, you know, the spankings don't do any good anymore? He's so twisted and rebellious that he simply will not respond. You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. Now, if you wanted to go back and look at some of the cursings, like in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, you will perhaps recall when the people stood on one side of the mountain to bless, and the other people stood on the other side of the valley on the other mountain to curse, and the law was read, and the people by their hundreds of thousands and millions said, "Cursed be he that lieth with a beast," and thousands of them said, "Amen." Cursed be he that discovers the nakedness of his, and then it went on, you know, different kin, and members that are close family. Amen. Cursed is anybody who indulges in homosexuality, etc. Amen. Now, if God says you go ahead and dive head first into all these evil curses, then the following curses are going to overtake you. And here follows an incredible list of modern medicine. Diseases of the heart, of the eyes, of the hearing, of the body, of the mind. The diseases of Egypt, degenerative diseases, and now we have, of course, man-made diseases, so to speak, which afflict and affect every part of our body. Today, they're wondering what to do with little children who are coming to school in the New York public school systems with AIDS. They got it from their parents. They got it at birth. Now, it was supposed to be a disease. You know what it is. It is a syndrome, which means that the body has no resistance to other diseases. So any infectious disease, you just get it. Your body simply is unable to build up the antibodies through any known system, naturally or apparently through the various inoculations and vaccinations they might give, such as for typhus or yellow fever or polio, that are effective and do generally work in society today to build up antibodies to protect young people against getting that kind of a disease, like poliomyelitis. Well, these little children are not only susceptible to other diseases, but they apparently could be highly communicative, so they could give AIDS to other children just through contact, like shaking hands or whatever you would do. So there's quite a debate about whether or not children with that syndrome should be allowed into the public school systems. You recall reading in the first chapter of the book of Romans about those who did not want to retain God in their knowledge, that they were all a pack of homosexuals, and that God said they receive in their own bodies that recompense which was fit, or meaning appropriate. Mr. Dart and I were talking about that the other day, and I was mentioning one time I was wondering about where the very first case of venereal disease came from. There wasn't a visitor from outer space that had VD who infected somebody. It merely is a degenerative disease as a result of total lack of hygiene and of breaking God's laws with regard to a lot of very ugly things I will not go into in detail. But then from there on, these various, we know, new colonies of germs are being created virtually every day, and new strains that resist certain attempts to destroy them. So we have super germs and super bugs and super viruses today that resist the various flu inoculations and so on, and you get it anyway. They once asked a hippie commune out in Big Sur, would they please abstain from sexual relations for about 6 months so the county health department could treat some of these people who had developed a raging case, a very virulent venereal disease that simply could not be treated with penicillin and some of the wonder drugs. The hippies all said, no, we won't. So fine, leave them alone. So now you have little kids being born blind, mentally deficient, mentally ill, or with AIDS, or with some venereal disease right out of the womb. But you can't tell people in this society to abstain, to obey God's laws, to do that which is right, even for the sake of their own unborn infants. I'm dumbfounded at the number of young pregnant girls who resist and refuse giving up cigarettes and alcohol. Both of them, terrible pollutants which can virtually destroy a developing baby within their bodies, but they won't do it. They just simply won't do it. Now, by analogy, you're looking at the entirety of the nation. So you could say when he says the whole head is sick, he's talking about government. But mentally, our peoples in this country are mentally ill. And I think at a disproportionate rate, higher by far than many a very backward third world developing country like Afghanistan or some country like even we're seeing the terrible film as I was seeing on PBS last night. Of the drought over in Ethiopia, Eritrea, where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are dying. And it was a very sickening thing to watch that, with people actually running out there and picking up out of the dust one or two little grains of wheat that would drop from a sack, and just desperate. And it just showed, it was like a scene out of a hell, literally, to watch some of that television of those starving people over there today. Yet mentally, for all their physical debilities, their lack of food, nation after nation in Africa, where we could talk they're a savage, primitive, tribal society, they don't have culture, they don't have education, they may not even have a written language, and you can't find a single mental case among them all. I mean, we, in our overfed, undernourished country of modern medicine, are of all people sick mentally, more than any other people perhaps in the world. The whole heart faints, not talking about heart disease, there again the Bible, and in researching a little bit this morning through this, there are literally hundreds, not just saying that for effect, but literally hundreds of references in the Bible if you look up the three words, mind, heart, and thought and thoughts. There are hundreds. David stands out, columns of the word heart and mind in the Psalms. Solomon stands out, dozens and dozens, about your heart and your mind and how it is supposed to think and where it's supposed to be focused and the thoughts that are supposed to be coming into your mind and what your mind is supposed to be dwelling upon and the whole concept of the Old and the New Covenant. It was written in the fleshly tables of the human skin and flesh. Now it will be written in the tables of our hearts and of our minds that we're to worship God with our whole heart, etc. From the sole of the foot to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers, devour it in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. Now back in Romans 1, and beginning in verse 21, I referred to this in passing a moment ago. Basically, we're reading here of the underpinnings of all of modern education. We're reading of the underpinnings of that entire profession that is in place to educate every young American person so that that person can become a functional member of society. When you learn the three R's, you don't remember, and I don't either, when the first moment was that you learned to make the R or the A or a housetop A, or a round O, or an oval O, or learn your penmanship, I do not remember. My mind cannot go back. I vaguely remember the story about Jimmy the Microbe and about the huge hurricane. He's hanging on one of the hairs inside the esophagus of somebody with a cold. And I remember little things. I don't remember when somebody first explained to me the Dewey Decimal System, or when I first learned to make an R or an A or an E or an I or an O, but I did. And eventually, in the first, second, third grades, I was writing and I was reading little books, See Jane Run, See the Dog Run, See Spark the Dog, See Spot, and so on. Jack went up the hill, and then I learned the other version. But anyway, we learned how to read and how to write. And all the way along, by the first grade, and the second grade, and the third grade, the teachers and the books were subtly putting all sorts of things into my mind. They put Mother West Wind and Bambi and Grimm's fairy tales and Hansel und Gretel, who actually roasted a witch and tried to eat up her whole house and wondered why she got mad. They put into my mind the evolutionary concept. Even though my dad was preaching away every Sabbath, I came out of high school unable, really on my own until much later on in life, to explain cavemen and Adam. I mean, I couldn't reconcile them. So subtly, all along the way, in the process of education, I had been taught in secular education knowledge and information which denied the existence of God, and which tended to urge me to believe that there really is no God, but that mankind was 4.5 billion years of age. In church, I was hearing about Adam and Eve and the devil and God and angels and the Bible. But in school, I was having the evolutionary concept put into my mind. Now, who were the greatest men in all of ancient history who to this day are revered as geniuses, as literists, as writers and authors, philosophers and poets, artists and scholars, the great thinkers of the great schools, who would have been like the professors of yesteryear, even hundreds of years before Christ, where a person would, you know, conduct his own odyssey and go 3, 4, 5 nations and 4,000 miles to sit at the feet of one of these great scholars. Who were they? Well, you know some of the names. There are dozens of them, but we think of Plato and of Socrates and of Philo and of Diogenes and of Epictetus and of some of these others, perhaps. And we think of some of the great historians like Pliny, and we think of many of these great men in the so-called Ante-Nicene Fathers period, where they're arguing religion down in the 300s A.D., and you read some of their writings, and it's so much gobbledygook. It's so much double talk. Now, almost all of these men were a pack of rotten, filthy queers. They were perverts. They loved little boys. They liked to do hideous things in public. They were voyeurs and exhibitionists. Now, please forgive me if I tend to question whether or not something of great value can really come from such a mind. But I do basically question it as to whether or not something of great profound wisdom and value can come from a perverted mind. Now here, beginning in verse 19 and 20, we read verse 18, rather, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And it should read, who hold back the truth, by the way. The Greek word is katabalo, that means down in place or in time. Who hold back the truth, or resist the truth, or suppress the truth, not that they hold it, meaning believe it, in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God or about God is evident to them, as it should read. For God has shown it unto them. I could take any group of young people out here to a cut in the highway. I could take them to the Grand Canyon. I could take them to the lower reaches of the Colorado River. I could take them up to Arkansas. I could take them to any mountain formations where any bulldozer shown me any little bit of the exposed portion of the soil, and I could prove to them the flood of Noah. Like we were up there and we stopped at a place in Colorado and there was a seam of coal there and so on, and we're pulling out with our hands, and I brought a handful of them home again, some graphtolites and ammonites and clams and oysters and so on that have been there for who knows how many thousands of years. It may have been Noachian in origin because it was so near the surface. But the proofs of God in science and biology and chemistry and all the physical sciences and astrophysics in the abstracts of mathematics, in Newton's law of gravity, in anything to do with astronomy, in anything to do with the physical sciences, such as propulsion by steam or electricity, or the amount of energy unleashed in a lightning storm, the very properties of creation itself, the fact that the Earth is exactly the distance it is from the sun and the moon, the way the stars act and the planets act, the tide in the oceans. The evidences of the existence of God, even within your own mind, the human eye, the human ear, the human hand, sexual reproduction, the miracle of that, of how that can happen, the recreation of ourselves in love, in marriage, to be able to have another human being born that looks like us, the proofs, the evidences of the existence of God, and therefore that God is superbly and supremely intelligent and is working out a purpose for mankind, is really everywhere evident to the smartest man or the dumbest man who ever lived. It is not the private province of someone who is educated according to this world's standards. It's evident to them, he says in verse 19, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things about him, and I'll paraphrase it, are understood by looking at the things he has made. They're understood by looking at the creation, things which are, things which work and function, things which do exist, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, didn't worship him or obey him, neither were they thankful, they don't praise him in looking at his works, but became vain in their imaginations. I've seen that happen to young students in college. I've seen that happen to old men. I've seen that happen to all kinds of people. And I am sort of an observer, you might say, of human nature in life. And there are a lot of scars. Not all of them are visible inside my tough old leathery hide. But I have seen men come and go. I have seen men come through college with very limited ability, who might have even had difficulty in getting into college under different times, with maybe about a 101, 102 IQ, become men of such great swelling, toadish vanity, such assumed ability, and great power that they use to lord it over other human beings that it's embarrassing. I've also seen very underachieving people with maybe certain personality quirks who aren't very attractive to look at physically, who deep down inside were some of the most beautiful human beings you've ever met, who were good and gentle and meek people, but did not have the ostentatiousness and didn't have the vanity and didn't have the outward flair or verve or personality or whatever that other underachievers might have had. They became vain in their reasoning or their imaginations and their foolish heart. Now, always, you know, the Bible is speaking, when it says heart, metaphorically, of your brain. Not talking about the heart that they took and what they do with it. I guess they just threw it away. Maybe they chopped it up and fed it to the cat. Maybe they've got it there in a bottle of alcohol. But there is a heart that was keeping a human being alive with which he was born. It was formed in the womb of his mother, and they took it out of him the other day and put it on the shelf in a pickle jar, I guess. Now what's keeping him is alive is a couple of pumps. And inside of him is a mechanical machine going like this, and they can feel his pulse, and there's that thing beating away. I was thinking, how are they going to know when to disconnect it? Because when he dies, it will not be his heart that fails, will it? Unless there's a power shortage, and I imagine they've got a Honda auxiliary generator cranked up out there someplace. If all the power in the whole United States goes out, that heart's going to keep beating. They're going to have to beat that heart to death with a stick when his liver failed. But they're going to blame it on his kidneys or his liver, but it will not be that mechanical heart. And it's all you see in the news, and I frankly am sick to death of it. I'm sick and tired of looking into a human chest cavity with a lot of blood and scalpels and knives for my morning toast and coffee. It just drives me up the wall. I wish they'd get off of that subject, because people are so desirous of medical science finding the answer to aging and finding some way by which they can be kept alive mechanically or artificially from now on. And maybe we could just sort of be the bionic man. You know, people are dumb enough that some people actually believe that eventually science will probably produce false, you know, eyes through which we can see, and mechanical ears, mechanical hearts. All we'll need really is a can of WD-40, and we just go on our way. That's all we need from now on. Just keep all the parts moving, and here we go. Well, that's people's worship of science. Professing themselves to be wise, and I've been around a lot of those people in academe, the backslapping and the the sort of cardboard hats and the degrees and all of that type of thing. They became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, their imagery of their false gods and so on, and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore, God gave them over, gave them up, just let them have uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts. And I'll never forget how one of the top men of modern evolutionary science actually admitted, and I got the quotations in there in the book in my office, that he had a motive for wanting to deny the existence of a creator, and that motive was sexual in nature. He just plainly said it. Because if we admitted that God existed, then of course that would mean that God has certain mores and certain standards and laws, and that would interfere with our personal preferences. It would mean that there are laws there in place to be obeyed. And so he admitted that they had a motive for not wanting there to be a God. To dishonor their own bodies between themselves. A lot of pagan, creepy perverts who changed the truth of God or exchanged it for a lie or into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Because of this, God gave them up to vile affections. When I was in Seattle the other day in the newspaper, a homosexual club was just up. They were so in arms that they were almost ready to put on their sneakers and have a mince in on the courthouse steps because the city fathers had denied them in their club a liquor license. They wanted to start serving liquors in their bar where they have a bath. They have all these baths and showers and all of them get in there together. They've got all these private rooms, these lounges and TV sets and so on. They're all a pack of rotten, filthy homosexual queers. And they were just mad at the city fathers because they're denied a liquor license. And it is so blatant, it's unbelievable. Well, you read Mr. Dart's article coming up in the next issue of Watch Magazine about, you know, the speech. He didn't go into the homosexual aspects of what old Jesse Jackson said out there in San Francisco, but he did say it. Where you have a political party in our country literally opening up their arms, wanting to embrace lesbians and homosexuals, and you've got arguments going on as to whether they ought to be college professors and daycare center operators. And there are legal moves afoot to try to force some judges or justices of the peace to perform marriage ceremonies between two men or two women and let them adopt a foster child and raise the child as their own in marriage. One of these days, one of those idiots is going to lead a horse to the altar and the judge isn't going to know whether to turn him down or not. That's just about how far they have gone. For this cause, God gave them up to vile affections, for even their women, like Gloria Steinem and some of these women that come to mind, the head of these women's lib movements, and if I dare say anything about that, I'm probably in trouble with half of the audience, but I can't help myself. I am not for women's lib in the way they're for it. I am for equality. If a woman does the same job alongside me in an office that I do, she ought to be paid the same. Enough of that without taking an hour to explain myself and say all of my best friends are women. I don't need to do that. My mother was one, my wife is one, and you know that. But nevertheless, why it is that women's lib has to be in the hands of lesbians and women who probably wish they were policemen or paratroops is beyond me, but it seems to be. For even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature, and likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another. I don't understand that. I confess there are some things in this world I can understand. I can understand certain types of temptations. I can understand how people could sin in this way or that way. I can even understand why somebody might cheat at cards if he's, you know, sick, if he just got a sickness about money and so on. And I've seen that done right in my own, you know, right there on the table where I was playing. I've actually witnessed people cheating at cards. It just amazes me that that could go on. I can understand how a desperately poor and starving person or a person with who's been out of a job for a year and got some hungry kids at home might steal. I can understand a lot of temptations that would come along. I can't understand a child molester, a series or a serial murderer or any kind of a murderer. I cannot understand murder under any circumstances of any portrayal you could imagine except, you know, in self-defense. I can understand that. Someone's trying to kill me, someone's trying to kill my wife. I can understand the temptation for me to grab a gun and blow him completely into a pink mist. That I understand. But just going out and killing somebody, I cannot understand it. My mind just doesn't cope with that. But what I understand almost least of all Because, you know, I've been a member of various health clubs, and I've been in colleges and in the steam room and the sauna, and I've been to the local YMCA, and I'm just thankful that women, apparently, for some totally strange, unknown reason to me, find a male body attractive. Because it's a mystery. I don't know how or why they possibly could. Oh, I can see where, you know, broad shoulders or well-shaped arms or something like that, a guy playing basketball or a football player, and they could say, well, he's athletic or something like that. Yeah, fine. But you know what I'm saying. I don't understand homosexuality. It is something I cannot envision for the life of me, why that could ever be a temptation. Yet the scripture is telling me these men, because of leaving the knowledge of God, denying his existence, become so twisted that they leave the natural use of the woman and they burn in their lust one toward another. Now there's a little waiter down here in a restaurant. I kind of watch that guy because I don't want him coming too close to my table. A couple of times I've done this. I don't do it to him. He's got a short haircut. I've done this in the past. Guy will come over to my table, and when I know that he's a homosexual, I just say, no, you know, I will not let him serve me. One guy came over one time, and I said, no, don't come near my table without a hairnet on. Go get a hairnet and then come back, but I don't want you bending over my food with your hair. Long-haired waiter, and I just told him that. He was very upset. He got very sour. Didn't like me at all, but that's all right. I just didn't want him handling my food. Now, I think I have that right in society. I understand this thing called AIDS is extant. I don't know what that guy was doing last night or this morning. I don't want him with his thumb in my split pea soup. I don't want his thumb in my fork or my spoon. I don't want his hands on the plate from which I'm going to eat. So the little perverted queer, the other day, standing down here, and I can't even begin to imitate the way he's walking, and I look at him in dumbfounded amazement, the little pervert has an earring in his ear. He's got a pierced ear and a little fake diamond in his ear. And I'll tell you, I didn't know whether to walk over there and just yank him up by the shirt and say, hey, fella, would you please go in there, strip down, take a look in the mirror, and find out what you are, and maybe give him a couple of clues about what he ought to look for. And, you know, if you are a man, why don't you act like one? But you're just really tempted to just really put him down. But then, you know, about a third of the restaurant may rise up and say, you leave him alone. You never know what's going to happen. Maybe the manager is going to come and get on your case. But I do confess, and both Mr. Dart and Mr. Sharp, Ron and Benny, were with me at lunch, and they know exactly who I'm talking about, because this guy is as queer as the proverbial $3 bill. And I will not let him ever serve me either. You watch, you fellas, you're ever with me, he comes to my table, I'll just tell him, get out of here. Anyway, how in the world that happens, I do not understand. They burn in their lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. Now, medical science will tell you that homosexuality, not only medical science, but I think psychologists, psychiatrists, and environmentalists, and perhaps some other people too that might get into the act, like biologists and Margaret Mead, will tend to tell you that queers are born. I don't believe that for a minute. I know there can be aberrations. I know there can be physical, grotesque things, everything from Siamese babies to hermaphrodites. I used to say in the radio, and I'd get letters, and they would just really take me to task, there is no such thing as a morphodite. One guy wrote me in, Garner, Ted, you're an ignorant man. There is two, and I done seed one time. Well, all I was trying to do is make the point that people mispronounce and butcher up the English language. Hermes was a pagan god of ancient Greece, and Aphrodite was a pagan goddess of ancient Greece, a goddess of love and so on. Well, Hermes and Aphrodite were put together, meaning the perfect male with the perfect female, meaning a blend of two, so that because of some terrible mix-up somehow, just like a Siamese twin situation, if a human being is born that is sort of half and half, and it has happened, medical records prove it, they were called an hermaphrodite. I have no idea which role they would have followed in life, and maybe with something like that there ought to be an operation. Don't ask me, because I don't like to get into gigantism or things that are grotesque, and I don't have the solutions or the answer to it. But biologically, that's the only exception that I would know of. Otherwise, my statement, I'll stand by it, for the simple reason that the Word of God says that homosexuality is a sin. Now, where it is in the mind. I'm a fairly good imitator. I could tell you a story and I could lapse into a black colloquial accent because I hear pretty good, and when I do, I retain it and I know how they sound. I could imitate a Spanish-American accent or a Dutch-American accent or an Italian-American accent or a New York Jewish accent or a West Texas accent maybe. But I could also mimic a homosexual, because a homosexual is mimicking other men who are mimicking other men who think they're mimicking women. I've never seen a homosexual who is mimicking a woman, because women don't walk like that. They don't carry their heads like that. They don't talk like that. I don't see women going around like this, where every time they turn on the fan, their wrist sort of blows in the wind. I just don't see it happening. A lot of women are walking along just like this, you know, and you kind of give them a little bit of room, because some women are weightlifters nowadays and weight trainers and so on and trying to get into the armed forces and carry weapons and everything else. But homosexuality is, believe it or not, a state of mind. I honestly do believe in one case that I knew of, and I suspect that he was queer as a $3 bill, and later on it was proven, and I won't go into that, fellow with whom I actually shared a room along with Gerald Waterhouse and another gentleman who would take his long walks in the evening, and now I know where he went and why, but I didn't then. And he was in a home where there was no father figure present. He was reared by a mother and I think had three older sisters. Now, sure, okay, there are some excuses. I can sort of understand that, but I can't understand why a conscious choice was made, especially after he'd been in the Church of God and was right at the very center of the work and was actually overseas and helping to raise up overseas offices, and then to revert to that form of life and become a hopeless homosexual. But I'll tell you, I don't have all the answers, because when I, as a minister, have actually had a young man or two in the course of my 25, 30 years or whatever, break down and cry, tell you they detest it, that they hate it, that they don't want to be that way, but that somehow they can't seem to help it, then I've got to say it must take a miracle from God to change it. But I'm saying that the most masculine man you ever knew, if he just wants to be a good imitator, could start imitating a queer. Just imitate him. Just be like one. Just start pursing his mouth in funny ways and letting his wrists get limp and walk around and mince around a little bit. And if he does it long enough, if he does it often enough, he could do what? He could become one. He could become one. Now follow what I'm saying, because I'm talking about our human mind. Garbage in and garbage out. You are, it's been said, what you eat physically. Well, that's very true. And mentally, you are exactly what you think. Now to give you some hope, first I want to interrupt myself and then I want to come back to this other subject, because I told you I was going to tell you about Matthew. And the thing that made me mad, I'd like to see this guy. Maybe I'll get a hold of him and talk to him a minute, because I don't like it. Back at some point in time, there was a young man who used to work with us, and there was some female evangelist that was going to come through here, and they wanted to get a hold of David and Matthew, take them up here to the real Palm Isle, and parade them up on the platform, and let this screeching woman evangelist grab a hold of them by the ears and say, "Be healed." Well, we had a lot of real sanctimonious people. This one young guy just thought, this is going to be marvelous. And of course, without really knowing a lot about it, and that was about 5 years ago, my sons weren't quite as mature and far enough along as they are now. They'd read the flyer. Here's this woman, and here are these testimonials, and all these people, and oh boy, they've been healed, and she's healed the blind, she's healed the deaf. Sure she has, sure. So they're going to take these kids up there, my sons, and get them on that platform. Well, I threw just about half of the Pacific Ocean of cold water all over that plan in a big hurry. I also remember one person that claimed that had a friend of theirs someplace up here in Arkansas, Oklahoma, they knew could heal the boys. I said, bring him down here. They wanted me to come up there. I said, no, you bring him down here. I'll send him first-class airfare. Send him all of his expenses, give him a place to stay, get him down here. Never showed up. Never did know why. Never would take me up on that offer. Well, a couple days ago, my son, you know, I put an ad in the paper, he's trying to sell his car. So he gets a call, this guy's going to buy his car. Well, I don't know why they ended up in Mother Francis Hospital in the parking lot. I guess they're just driving around. But he's telling me about it last night at home. I never heard about it before in my life. This guy is driving along, and they go over there, and he's talking to Matthew, so he suddenly turns to him and he says, "Do you know Jesus Christ?" Matthew says, "Of course." And so all of a sudden, Matthew would have to be here. If he were here, I'd ask him to get and tell you about it. But he was saying he began to get the wildest look in his eyes. He said he reached out and he grabs him by the head. And he starts screaming so loud that even Matthew could hear him. And in the top of his lungs, he's praying and all this and saying, "Be healed," and all this stuff over and over and over again. He looks at Matthew and he says like this. He said, "Do you hear?" Matthew says, "No." And so, boy, he hit it again real hard, you know, and he says, "Now do you hear? Do you hear anything at all?" Matthew said, "No, nothing." And I forget, Cheryl could fill me in about any other details, but dumbest thing I ever heard. Now, you know, I've never had that temptation. I've had the desire. I've had the thought cross my head. It's always been real embarrassing to me to stand in a civic auditorium with 6,000 people and watch them wheel 14 people in there in a wheelchair. Been very embarrassing. Very embarrassing. It was embarrassing to see Mammy come and sit year after year after year after year with that giant tumor. And I never did once have. I had the desire. I had the thought. I had the wish. But I never had the urge or the temptation to just walk up to Mammy and grab her by the belly and say, "Belly, disappear." Because unless or until I knew as much as I know exactly right now where my pickup truck is sitting, or that is a stone fireplace, or this is a wooden pulpit. I mean, if I knew as much as I know anything that was going to happen, then I would have done it. But if I don't know, then I got some vanity, I'm sure. I mean, you can probably see that a whole lot easier than I can, so let's just both admit it. I got some vanity, all right? I hope not a whole lot, but I got some, all right. But I don't have that much. I don't have enough vanity to do what that kid did to my son. And I'll tell you, I'd like to just talk to him rather sternly and say, you're a fool. You're a fool to stick yourself clear out in left field like that. You're off in your mental, your upper story. You're actually crazy. You're sort of a weirdo, and you shouldn't be running around loose, scaring the daylights out of young deaf boys. You're not a healer, and you ought to be willing to admit to yourself, I'm a fake. I'm a fraud. Whatever was going on in my mind, I thought I was going to be a great evangelist, or I'm going to get famous, or I'm going to heal people. Forget it, fella. You're just a weirdo with a weird idea full of vanity that made an absolute ass of himself in public. That's what I like to tell a young man. Maybe I'll get a chance to do that. But you see, I meet more of these people than you do because they do not normally seek you out. But my telephone rings, and you'll be amazed at some of the things that are said to me on my telephone. I got a card or a letter the other day. There's some gal that calls down here, and she'll give a different name every time. One time her name was Armstrong. Well, this time her name was Eve. My name was Adam. And she sent a whole flock of pictures. Apparently it was her whole family, a husband and a bunch of grown kids and everybody all around. And it said, "Dear Adam, I love you and I need you. Please come to me, Eve." She'll call down here and once or twice she'll use some rather foul language. And once or twice she said, "How'd I join y'all's church?" And I said, "Well, I'd have to, you know, let somebody up there talk to you about that." And she'll say, "This is Virginia." Say, "Who?" "Virginia." Say, "Virginia who?" "Armstrong." "Oh, your name's Virginia Armstrong?" She'll say, "Yeah." And then she'll say something real snotty and say, "I'm sorry, I don't have time." Wham, hang up on her. But she's only one. I'm talking about a whole bunch of calls from all over the place over the course of years. There are more people who go out of their tree over religion. And they need help, and of course, I don't mean to be callous. I have helped a lot of them. I have literally talked to people who were so drunk they could hardly talk. I've talked to people who were suicidal. I don't just normally hang up on everybody just the minute they tell me that they're a weirdo, which they normally don't, but you know what I mean. I don't normally do that. So I wanted to mention that they're just all over the place. Well, now, you know, the thought has come to me oftentimes in dealing with my own personal, deeper problems. There's a difference between, I think, mind and heart and the way the Bible uses it, because with my mind, I might be thinking one thing, but then there's that deeper aspect that we call heart, which is the private psyche way down deep inside yourself where you really live, where you're honest with yourself. Now, David continually did some things with which a lot of us could take great exception. So let's just think about that for a moment. I remember preaching a sermon about David, the kind of a man he was. As a young lad, we don't know anything of his personal situation. We only come upon the scene when he's the lesser of Jesse's kids who was being interviewed by Samuel because God has said that among Jesse's boys there's going to be a king of Israel. And we learn that he had actually killed a lion and a bear with his bare hands or with a slingshot or whatever. And we learn then, when he is given the opportunity to confront Goliath, that he's a man of tremendous courage and not a lick of vanity. That it wasn't vanity. His brothers had vanity, but he didn't. He just had what is simple courage. I doubt if there was a total absence of fear. It was just that David was so concentrating on the power of God, it was an anomaly. It didn't make sense to him. It was ridiculous that this giant could be standing there, and the whole army of Israel is there, and where his brothers are seated right there beside Saul, and they're all in their huge encampment, and there are tens of thousands of Israelites, and David comes up with her some duffel and so on, some clothing, some things from the house, maybe some food, to give to his brothers. And his brothers look at little old David, and they say, "What is the naughtiness of your heart that you're come up here to see the battle?" And I thought, what a dumb statement. For days, the Bible says, Goliath comes out with a shield bearer, a little guy with full armor, lugging this shield, you know, barely able to totter along and drag it behind this guy who's approximately 12 feet tall. We got 7-footers, just commonplace now in our society, playing basketball, and sometimes two of them on one team. I think Saul was probably 10 feet, looking at the cubit of Ezekiel, the cubit of biblical measurement, and Goliath probably 12 feet tall. Mammoth of a man, just about shook the earth when he walked. Every day he would come out and shake his spear in the air and say, "Send me some dog of an Israelite, and we'll just settle it here and there. I'll prevail against him." Well, Saul's the king, and of course, the buck stopped there. He's the one man upon whom, of course, all the responsibility devolved, and so it was very embarrassing, no doubt. So Saul did the next best thing he could think of, no doubt without a lot of embarrassment and chagrin. He said, "I'll give my best, you know, good-looking little girl here, and I'll make him rich, and I'll make him second man in the realm, anybody who can go out and kill that dirty giant." And it was, he didn't get around to saying, you know, that I don't really think I should, or maybe that he might fail. He just didn't even broach that subject at all. So David shows up, and we know the story of David. And it's told to children in Sunday schools and so on. But it happens to be a very true fact of history. But David didn't just take one stone, he took five. He happened to hit him with the first one. But there was no bravado, there was simple total trust in God. Now to tell you a little bit about David, there were a lot of things he did God didn't necessarily approve of. It said that he was a bloody man. If you recall, later on Saul reneged on his promise. And David thought Michael's a pretty good-looking young girl. So fine, he was ready to claim Michael. He brought the huge head of Goliath up there. And later on, David used his sword, you remember. And it lasted for years in the archives and was surfaced even years later on after David was gone. So David took his armor from him, and his great big two-handled sword was probably about 4.5-5 feet long. And David comes struggling up there with the head of the giant, presents it to Saul, and Saul reneged on his promise. He wouldn't give him Michael. He said, "Well, you go get me 100 foreskins of the Philistines." Now, you know, David didn't set up a clinic and say, "If all of you Philistines who want to be circumcised, just step forward." He didn't do that. He went out and probably they weren't all that willing to part with them. But you know the story. He got 200. Not 100, but 200. Now, I really imagine he had to kill all those guys to do what he did. And I think we know that that's exactly what he did. Someday, it would be marvelous if Hollywood would really make a truly epic movie. But I mean, if you want to see some blood, can you imagine a guy making a movie of how David went out like old liver-eating Johnson, you know how bloody of a movie that was if you saw it, that swore he would get even for the ones that killed his wife and unborn child, and actually would kill and eat the liver of Crow Indians while they watched him. He'd cut their liver out, start eating it while they were dying. It really happened in history. It's called Liver-Eating Johnson. And this literally happened up there. Crazy Woman, which is a VOR that I've flown over, is named after the woman who went absolutely crazy from that wagon train up there because of what the Indians did to her. Anyway, that's up in Wyoming. But could you imagine a movie of what David did? Now, later on, you see what happened in the case of Bathsheba. But there's an awful lot, notwithstanding what he did to Uriah the Hittite and so on, about David that we don't know. The point is that David was a man of great appetites, of great emotions. He was a powerfully built man. He was a skilled warrior. He knew how to wield a sword and a spear and a bow and a sling. He was a man that literally got down in the dirt and grunting and wrestling around with a lion roaring at him and trying to claw him to pieces, killed the lion with his bare hands. And if he came striding in this room right now, dressed in his leather girdle with his short skirt and those great big thongs around his leg and stood about 6'4", and probably with a big reddish beard or something like that, with sweat and blood all over him, with a bag of 200 foreskins in his hand, it wouldn't be the picture of little, dark, swarthy, Jewish-looking, lissome 17-year-old David that you have in your mind. Let me tell you that if a great, big, grubby Israelitish warrior came crashing in here and stood up here and said, "I'm David," with blood on his beard, and his beard clear down to here about that full, you know, and some kind of a leather helmet with a little spike sticking out the top, you wouldn't recognize him, and neither would I. Now, here's the point I want to make. Let's turn to 1 Kings 11 and verse 4. Do you ever get the concept that maybe it's too late for you? Do you ever begin to think, well, I don't know if God's ever going to let me get in his kingdom or not? I think Satan the devil would like a lot of people to think that. This is about Solomon, and I'm going to read up to it from verse 2. Of the nations concerning which the Eternal said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go in unto them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives. You know how many wives David had? You ever count them all up? I believe it was exactly 7, but it may have been as many as 12. I'd have to go back and try to name them all. But God provided David with at least 7 and maybe more wives after Michael. Nabob was actually removed out of the way by a heart attack from Almighty God because God saw what was developing, and in my own mind I've always been convinced, you may disagree with me, and this is not doctrine or dogma, but I've always been convinced that God knew that if he didn't do that, David was going to pull another Bathsheba, and God simply didn't want the temptation to be there. But anyway, you can read the account. And David married her, as he did all those others, and he had a whole swarm of concubines, didn't he? Now, just think about that, with all that that means in our society today, the way we would look at it, the way you ladies would judge David, the way I would judge him, or anybody else would, the way the church would judge him today. Now, here's Solomon, who went him a whole lot better. He had 1,000 altogether, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old, and he might have got old real quick, who knows, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Eternal his God, as was the heart of David his father. Now that tells me in the Word of God that there is something different between what God calls the mind and the heart. That a person with his mind can make mistakes, can commit sins, can say things and do things which are not basically a deliberate act which is motivated from the heart. David continually wrote about the heart. I want to show you a few examples of that right quickly. Let's go to Psalm 26:2. There are literally hundreds, as I said, and to go through a whole lot of them would not make a lot of sense, but just a couple for a little bit of flavor. Examine me, O Eternal, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. For your loving kindness is before mine eyes, and I have walked in your truth. Psalm 57:7 is another one. We're all aware of the 51st Psalm, of the prayer following the sin with Bathsheba, and how David said, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. But Psalm 57 and verse 7, he says, my heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. That happens to be a true statement. We read in the inspired Word of God, inspired by the Holy Spirit, that for all he did, the bloodiness, the double, you know, murder tally of the Philistines, sending Uriah out actually in a conspiracy to have the man killed, murdering a human being, to get rid of him so he could marry his wife when he'd already committed adultery with her before that time, and she was expecting a child. And then God, of course, caused the child to die. I mean, David got himself involved in some hideous situations. But all the time, in that deepest internal heart quality of his mind, his heart was perfect before God. Now, how are we going to deal with that? That, to me, gets down to a level that is very, very encouraging indeed, which I also encounter over in Exodus 4, 21, 7, 3, and 13. I won't turn to that because there must be 20 statements within about 4 or 5 chapters where it said that Almighty God hardened Pharaoh's
heart. And if you look up the meaning, there are several different words that are utilized in the Bible for mind and thoughts and heart and so on, and they're not all the same, either in Hebrew or the Greek. Just like in our English language, we use various terms to express the way our brain works and the way the thoughts of our mind or of our hearts perform. Remember our explanation of the times of the Gentiles. If you look back in Daniel 4:16 and also 5:21, you will see that Nebuchadnezzar went insane. But when he went insane because of what he said about taking all of the vain glory unto himself, and God had said that he would, he was given what is called the mind of a wild animal. Now God shows that that insanity that came upon Nebuchadnezzar for 7 years while he was grunting and running around in the backyard like a beast, like a depraved animal, eating and rooting at so many roots like a pig or a stupid armadillo, that he was as crazy as a loon, and Daniel was over the kingdom and was actually running the government along with Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, or even known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Babylonian, and that actually the government of Babylon was in the hands of the Israelitish prophets at that time. So he uses Nebuchadnezzar's insanity to characterize the kind of a mind that has governed Gentile nations all over the world, the kind of minds that were in Hideki Tojo and Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, the kind of minds that have been in people like Juan Perón and people right now in Central and South America with all their various guerrilla wars and their various right-wing dictatorships or the left-wing dictatorships. Both are dictatorships, the kind of minds that govern in the Kremlin today. You know, and I know, I don't care about the favorite conspiracy theories and all the kooks, nuts, and oddballs in the United States who believe that the CIA and all kinds of other organizations have all these secret things going on and in effect agree with the Kremlin. It's almost as if they agree that the worst criminal nation on the face of the earth is the United States of America, and it just is not. Reagan, in his heart, does not want war with the Soviet Union or anybody else, and I believe that with all of my heart. And I don't believe there's a man in the Congress or the Senate of the United States who in his heart wants war for this country. Do you? Do you really believe that? Are you into the conspiracy theories so deep you think there are people in our government who are trying to work it around where we're going to go to war? I don't believe it. I just don't believe it, and you'll never convince me of it. But what I know is, I know that in their hearts, the leaders in the Kremlin know that about the United States of America. So when they come out with all their pronouncements to deceive and to delude their own people, they are lying. They are portraying a scenario of Uncle Sam as the great Satan, and the warmonger, and Ronald Reagan with a cowboy image and his missiles and on, which they in their own hearts do not really believe. I mean, the top leaders in the Kremlin, their intelligence is superb. They have penetrated all the way to our institutions, you know, by and large, bar none, all the way into government itself. They can read every publication you can and don't think they don't. They can monitor every television program you do and don't think they don't. There is not a shred of information, and you could add to that 100 tons of other information you've never seen, that is not immediately available to the best brains in Soviet intelligence and in the Kremlin. And they understand that the United States is a soft, fun-loving, peace-desiring, non-warlike society. We don't want war. But if they're going to keep control over their people, they must portray the United States as a pack of warmongering, shoot-from-the-hip, missile-rattling, you know, warmongers and aggressors. Now, I could even draw an analogy of a church I know at this moment that does the same thing, where there are people who in their hearts know that I am not a threat to the worldwide Church of God. But what they must tell their people to keep them away is a different story. I won't go on and belabor that a little bit, but I think it is important to understand it. Jesus Christ of Nazareth said in Matthew 5 and verse 8, "Blessed is the pure in heart." Now, what does that mean? It means the clean of mind. It means the single-minded. It means a person who has the kind of a heart that David had. If you look at Matthew 6 and verse 21, he also said that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now, I look at all these empty seats here today, and I've never been one to preach to people who are absent or talk about the fact that I saw you with your eyes open in prayer. As I've said, it doesn't make any sense. But I do happen to know there are an awful lot of people who are playing church in this world, and people who lack real commitment, and people to whom what is going on here in Tyler is not really that important. It's kind of an adjunct. It's a side interest. It's kind of part of what's going on. There are people who are involved in it that are still sort of, I'm going to wait and see how it all turns out. And eventually, when things really get going good, then maybe I'm going to jump on the wagon and I'll be there. I'll be aboard, you know, when we've got big institutions and we're growing, we're worth $6, 8, or $10 million a year, something like that. Then it's going to be time to, all right, then I'll really, you know, put my shoulder to the wheel, get my hand to the spokes here, whatever, and I'll be aboard. But I honestly wonder oftentimes if there aren't a lot of people just sort of, you know, going through the paces and kind of waiting it out, whose commitment is not deep and is not of the heart. They have a part-time little mental commitment. A part of their lives are involved in what is going on, but not the whole heart of the individual, to the point that they're absolutely, totally committed. It says in Matthew 12 and verse 34, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. As I said, garbage in, garbage out. What comes out is what is down deep inside and what is down in there. So as I look at all of this, the fact that Gentile leaders have been said in the Bible to have been given the heart or the mind of a wild animal. It explains the depravity, the bestiality, the pogroms, the genocidal policies, the taking of lives of millions of human beings, the wanton destruction of whole races of people that have been attempted by some of these demonic human beings. I understand what that means. I know that there are millions of demons in the world. I know they deal with human minds. I've had people come to me and tell me about hearing voices and seeing things, and I have no doubt that they do. I've had problems or temptations or thoughts that would come to me and would try to get me to say or to think certain things. And I have learned, and I am able now to have that kind of control, that I can literally find my thoughts just going somewhere, and I can take them consciously and put my mind on a certain subject. I can start quoting a scripture. I can start singing a song. I can think about something I'm seeing as I'm driving along, a tree or whatever. And I can take my mind and I can wrestle my mind onto a different subject, reject the thoughts that are trying to intrude into my mind, and mentally, literally, force my mind to think of another subject. Now, in this world, you hear many sounds. Your eyes see many things. Your taste buds sample many tastes. And in this world, by and large, and you just like I, have a 7-day week with 24 hours in every day. Let's just ask ourselves, how much of a percentage of our time in every 24-hour day and every 7-day week is taken up with programming these very super-sensitive memory cells of ours, these incredibly intelligent, astute, vivid, brilliant, fathomlessly intelligent brains of ours, and they really are, more than any computer you've ever heard of. How much of our time during those 24 hours and 7 days times 24 hours do we spend in putting garbage in? And how much time do we spend in putting the mind and the knowledge and the beauty of God into these computers of ours? I can tell you of instances in my life that passed by in a fleeting breadth of a second. I remember an airplane crash on the deck of the Antietam, 11 lives lost. I'll never forget the guy with a bone sticking straight out of his arm, running, crying down there, running to sick bay. I'll never forget some of the sights and sounds that have happened in a split second of time where all of a sudden I can describe to you every color, exactly what the scene was, everything that went on, dozens of things. It was almost like my brain said, click, and took a Technicolor picture that I will never forget the rest of my life, which was compacted into one instant. Now I can sit here and you can ask me questions about what happened from 1958 to 1968 in the course of hundreds of sermons, thousands of hours of classes, thousands of radio broadcasts,
hundreds of decisions, hundreds of hours of counseling, and I will be a total blank. I won't remember any of it. There will be just dozens of things like that, hundreds of hours that I wrestled with where my mind was on it. I was in a department head meeting. It's very serious, and I'm really thinking, and we're trying to come up with a decision. I'm a blank. Hundreds of sermons where I've had my old pulse beating in my heart, just pounding away, and my palms were clammy, and I was flailing away and telling the people this. My mind's a blank. Can't remember a thing. But my brain, on a fleeting instant or two, in an automobile accident I once had, on the morning after my wife and I were married, I will never forget vividly about a second and a half that flashed into my brain just before I plowed into the back end of an old van on a rainy highway in Fort Worth and ruined the front end of my car and went all the way to California with a piece of wire keeping a hood down, parking to the back of the restaurant so people wouldn't have to look at it. But aren't you the same way? And, you know, you talk about this sense of deja vu because, you know, our minds are made up of who knows how many millions of little electrical sensory connections of some sort. Benny and I were spending some time at an avionics shop, and I won't belabor that, about avionics and radios and DMEs and RNAVs and ADFs and all that type of thing and the little things that can go wrong. If you look at the micro-miniaturization of computer chips and of the high-tech industries of our modern age, micro-miniaturization that gives us these little transistors about yay big, we can hold up to our ears and so on. Of all of the electrical circuitry, they can get into such a tiny little piece of space that it's smaller than your little fingernail, and yet it's circuitry that can do so much in the brain, as it were, of a computer. Well, your mind is a far more powerful and far more capacious computer than that. Now, we were just kidding, but there's a new game out called Trivia Quiz, and I was mentioning this morning. It's like there must be tens of thousands of pieces of unrelated information stored in the back of my head that I don't even know are there. We played it a few times in hunting camp. I kind of enjoyed it. A lot of the stuff I didn't know and I didn't care, and I'm not even going to try to find out because it truly is trivia that I would never pursue. But it's called Trivia Pursuit. And so you answer these questions. And I don't know who stood on second base in the third inning of the game between the Yankees and the Cardinals in 1934. Or whatever, they might ask me. But I did know which lake bordered Iran and the Soviet Union. I did know where the Sears Tower was. I did know who was married to Carol Lombard from 42 to 44. I knew a few unrelated, ridiculous things that had nothing to do with each other. I knew what the capital of Abyssinia was. Nobody else in the tent did, but I did. There were certain things that I knew. Okay, but when did I last learn that? Oh, I don't remember. Ghastly, it must have been 1950. I don't remember when I learned it. And it's never been asked me from that time to this. It's just been, where has it been? It's in there someplace. You can't go in there and sort through it and find it, but it's down in there somewhere. And when you interrogate the computer that is your brain by asking it that question, it quickly sorts through all of that stuff. So I said, well, you know, the brain is like a muscle. And I'm down here at the club, and I'm going through my routines and this and that, and building up the sweat and trying to get my body in reasonable physical condition, at least just to keep a certain amount of, if you call it, tensile strength in your muscles so you don't just turn to flab. You have to exercise the physical muscles of your body, your legs, your arms, your back, and so on, if you intend to keep strong. The same thing is true of your brain. It's where you live. It's really what's going on. You don't live in your hand or your elbow or your knee or your heel or your foot. You live inside of this thing encased in this bone. And the kind of a person you are, and the way you will react in an emergency, and the way you will treat other human beings, and whether or not you will get into God's kingdom, notwithstanding what your brain does or your mind does, is dependent upon what's going on in what the Bible calls your heart. Your heart. Now, sometimes I think a person can sin with the mind and not necessarily pollute his heart. And I point to the case of David for my proof. David surely sinned many times with the mind. The brain made the body desire something. And the body went out and got what the brain, through the eye, made the body desire. But it didn't contaminate his heart. When it was all said and done, he would cry out to God in that moment in prayer, when all of us ought to finally achieve that kind of prayer with God, when he was saying, in effect, don't let me deceive you, don't let me deceive myself, dig down, O Eternal, with the power of your Holy Spirit, deeper than my mind, deeper than my brain, deeper than my words. Get clear down inside the heart where the little timid I really live. And search me and try me and find out if there's any evil down in there. And create in me a clean heart, O God, and see if there be any evil inside of me. I want to turn to 2 Chronicles 31 for a moment. I think there's a fabulous example here in the life of one man. Back in the 31st chapter, sort of summarizing a little bit of Hezekiah's life, it said in verse 20, "Thus did Hezekiah throughout all Judah, and wrought that which was good and right and truth before the Eternal his God. And in every work that he began in the service of the house of God, and in the law, and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered." How many of you have heard the Elijah oratorio? Beautiful music. And I remember there's one oratorio, I think it's a tenor part, and I heard this out in the Civic Auditorium one time in Pasadena when they had brought, I think it was the Hartfordshire, whatever, anyway, Leeds, or no, wherever they were from. It was a big British group of singers, and the entire Ambassador Chorale joined in with them, and the whole orchestra, and they did the Elijah, and they had these professional voices there. Well, there's a tenor part that I never fail to absolutely break completely up. I'm just sitting in my seat, not making any noise. The old tears are just welling out of my eyes. When he sings that number, "If with all your heart you truly seek him, you shall ever surely find him." And the beauty of that music, it just breaks me up every time I hear it. If I had a record of that, I'd play it right now. And I don't think there'd be a dry eye in the place, because it is inspiring music. And you know, that is exactly what I'm trying to get across. Jesus Christ said, "Blessed are the pure in heart." I know that the music I listen to pollutes my mind. And I try not to, but I can't avoid it all. I'll be driving along in my car, and some of that stuff is absolute trash. You can take a piece of metal and grind it underfoot and record the sound and then put the guitar to it, and I'll tell you, it'll be a number one gold record hit. Some of this stuff out here that you hear is the most mind-boggling. The songs that I used to sing when I was a kid used to have verses and choruses. You know, they had parts to them, you know, a whole lot of parts. You take one little part of that song and pull it out, and then just repeat it about 10,000 times. "I want to have fun," and "I want to have fun." So you know by the time this song is over, that kid wants to have fun, because they said it 379 times, and they just say it over and over and over and over and over again. Now, do you honestly think that you could listen to that by the hour, and you are not planting something in your mind as surely as you plant a hickory seed in your backyard that is going to grow? I know better. We live in the age, and we could go down to the 7-Eleven, and whether they got it out in front of the counter or back behind the cashier is, and I can prove what I'm saying. Or we could go to the bookstore or wherever. We live in the age of total trash in literature. Look at the science fiction rack. Then go to the romance rack. Go down to Dalton's bookstore, and they got it all compartmentalized and departmentalized. And look at what is available down there of absolute rotten garbage. You can look at magazine stores, the really big ones. Do you know they have magazines that are designed for sadomasochists? Designed for people who are, as they say, into, what is the term they use? Dominance, being dominated, and so on, meaning the only way they can have a perverse, twisted sexual thrill if it's somebody to beat them half to death. I like to help them out. I'm just kidding. I shouldn't really say that. But sometimes you think that'd be the only way to really, really just go ahead and get the whip, you know, and just say, you know, be my guest, have fun, and just beat some sense into their stupid heads if you could do that, but you probably couldn't do it. Do you think that anybody could just avail himself or herself of all of this in society? And I cite television, all right? Now, I'm not condemning anybody, because I've watched all kinds of TV and I watch boxing. And I know that that must be getting some primeval urge to the surface in me, that vicariously I may have an urge in there to want to double up my fist and rock that guy's head and watch him fall like felling a 300-foot Douglas fir.
and let him bounce on the carpet the way you'll see one of them do once in a while. Maybe that's what I'm doing. Maybe I'm actually catering to some subliminal, buried little thing down there in my mind that I shouldn't be doing. I don't know. But I can't stand to watch soap operas. They all have the same set. It's a blank wall. And they stand there with just these faces. And they talk about triangles and divorce and all this stuff. And it's just all dialogue. And I can't understand why anybody would want to just sit there and just listen to all this stuff. Here's your whole life going by, your own life and your own family and your own mind and so on. And you're sitting there static. And you're watching this stuff that these other people are being paid fortunes. And then pretty soon I'm going to see them on the Gary Whatchamacallit show. And it's called the Morning Worship Hour. That's what I call it when they come on. And he is asking these actresses and actors, now it must really be difficult. How do you cope, you and Henrietta, you know, living a couple of states apart? And how about your career? Oh, it's really, really tough. You know, I don't get to see the kid once every other year or so, but and it's really tough. You know, they're making about $16 million a year, and they got about 5 or 6 homes and all this. And they tell us how difficult their lives are, these actresses and actors, and people are just devouring that. And I once remember how excited the kids were in college when they knew a country western singer was going to come. You can get people like that whose lives are absolutely empty and who have to stumble all over their lines and get coached, you know, and so on. But because you put their face on TV, a lot of people will bow down and practically worship them. But television, books, music, go to an art gallery and look at modern art sometime. Look at modern sculpture. And look at what the human mind from people like Salvador Dali and others have produced. And see what I'm talking about of polluting our human mind. And the 32nd chapter was when Sennacherib sent all of these people and tried to persuade Hezekiah to simply give up and said, God is never going to deliver you. And it said in verse 15, let not Hezekiah deceive you nor persuade you on this manner. Hezekiah, a man of whom we just read, did that which was good and right, and whose heart was set to seek God with all of his heart. No god or any kingdom was able to deliver his people out of my hand and out of the hand of my fathers. How much less shall your God deliver you out of mine hand? Verse 15. And his servant spake yet more against the eternal God and against his servant Hezekiah. And they railed on them and so on. Verse 20. For this cause Hezekiah the king, the prophet Isaiah the son of Amoz, prayed and cried unto heaven. And the Eternal sent an angel which cut off all the mighty men of valor, and the leaders and captains and the king of the camp of the king of Assyria. So he returned with shame to his own land. When he was come up into the house of his God, David came forth out of his own bowels, slew him there with a sword. And thus the Eternal saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and the hand of all other, and guided them on every side. Now Hezekiah was sick. He knew he was going to die. It scared him half to death. And he prayed, verse 24, to the Eternal. And he spake unto him, and he gave him a sign. And you can read of that elsewhere as well. But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him. He kind of took it for granted. He got a little bit prideful. He sort of forgot to give God gratitude and credit. For his heart was lifted up. Therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. But, notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Eternal came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah had exceeding much riches and honor. He made himself treasuries for silver and gold and stones and spices, shields, a manner of pleasant jewels, storehouses of all sorts of staples, stalls for all kinds of beasts and coats, or in other words, shepherd areas or enclosures for flocks. Moreover, he provided cities, the possessions of flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him very much substance. And Hezekiah stopped the upper watercourse of Gihon, brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. He was engaged in public works of improving the quality of life by bringing running water for thousands of other people. He prospered in all of his works, howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire the wonder that was done in the land. God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. So God put before Hezekiah a series of circumstances so that God could really try the man all the way to the depths of his heart. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his goodness, behold, they are written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet,
the son of Amoz, and the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the chiefest of the sepulchres of the sons of David and of all Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem honored him at his death. And Manasseh, who became a very wicked king, reigned in his stead. I think that is a cause for encouragement when I read of the case of Hezekiah, who found when his heart was lifted up that he humbled himself and died in a very good state with God, and of David, whose heart was perfect with God, notwithstanding all of the other problems that he might have had. God tells us through Christ's own words in Mark 12 and verse 30 that we need to love the Eternal, our God, with all your soul and with all your mind. And the Greek word is dianoia, which means with your faculty of mind, your imagination, and the exercising of your thoughts. In other words, with all of your thoughts. As I look at this and look at the way David prayed in Psalm 139, verse 23, search me and try my heart. I can say I believe, and it's the only thing I can say. I've made many, many mistakes in my life, and I'm probably going to make a lot more. And yet, if I look down at that very deep quality of heart, of what I really want out of life for myself, for my family, for the church, for the work here, and on out into the future for the Church of God International and for what we call the work, the kingdom of God, salvation, I say to myself, I can't get out of this life alive wearing this physical body I'm presently wearing. And if I get right down to my real wants, instead of some of those things that become daily concerns, little programs you get embarked upon, little worries or concerns that take up a lot of your time, a lot of planning that you put into something you want to do, places I want to go, things I want to do, short-lived, short-term projects. That's one thing. Mistakes I might make, sociological mistakes and other types and so on. That's another thing. Sins, some of them, sure, I'm sure they are. And yet, I can read what it says in here, and then in prayer to God, say, search me and try me and get right down into the very deepest longing of the heart and see where I'm coming from, where that part of me is concerned. And then is when I can take cheer and realize that hasn't changed, that my heart is set on God and His kingdom. And I think it's a good exercise for us to do that once in a while, because sometimes if you listen only to your mind, you forget what your heart is telling you.